As we mentioned earlier, I don't remember being the president. I remember being the vice president. Dick Cleveland was the president. And it seemed like Paul Lawrence, you remember, this is a long time ago. It seemed like Dick Cleveland, Paul Lawrence, and I, every month, if we didn't have a speaker, one of us had to volunteer to come up and show something. So I did quite a few back then. I was started out with the Roots 3 software, migrated up through the whole chain. It was when they went to that thing called Family Gatherings. This is UFT stuff. I was a beta tester for Family Gatherings, and that's when I really got into the details. And then finally the UFT. And I used to make a web page called the Miles Files, and I made it right out of UFT. And then it got to the point where I had too many names for the web page, and it took 48 hours of continuous CPU time to generate the web page. But that wasn't working, so Dick Cleveland wrote some software to make it a little faster. And so finally, Second Sight came out, and I had to go from UFT to TMG so that I could use Second Sight. That's the only reason I bought TMG, and so I could go to Second Sight. I actually used UFT the last update they put out was in the year 2000. And then this group started all migrating to TMG, and I said, I'm into genealogy, I'm not into software, and I don't want to switch systems, and UFT worked fine. So I used UFT about 10 years after that last update. I used it, I don't know how many years I used it too long, or if I went too many names or what happened, but I went too long. So when I finally moved into TMG for other reasons, I mean to use it as a working data loading software instead of just using it to get to Second Sight to build a web page. I had problems. Some things did not convert over as smoothly as I hoped, but I don't think it was a conversion process. I think it was I had bugs in UFT. I had problems in some of the data. And so I didn't get a smooth 100% transition. Maybe I got a 99% transition. But still today, I'll pull up something and the footnote will say, brother-in-law's will. I mean, that's not the source. So I still got, every once in a while, somebody will send me an email or down on my webpage, and they say, can you send me my grandmother's brother-in-law's will? And I go, no, well, you know, we're all not perfect. So I've been around for a while with this stuff. So this picture on the screen you're looking at is my backyard. I have a house right behind this tree here. We just walk out the backyard and ride our golf cart around the harbor here. This is a little place called Saxons, Virginia. It's on the eastern shore of Virginia. So now I need to find out a little bit about you guys. How many of y'all were born in Virginia? Oh, that's going to be interesting. Okay, I'll raise my hand, but that's two of us. How many of you know where the eastern shore of Virginia is? Now, I'm going to pick one of you as a test to be sure. This lady here. How do you get to the eastern shore?
By car.
And which road do you take?
I have no clue. I see the map.
Okay. Because I've asked some people if they knew where the eastern shore of Virginia is, and they go, sure. And I go, well, where is it? And they go, oh, you know, Norfolk, Hampton. I go, no, that's not the eastern shore. So how many of you have been to the eastern shore of Virginia? Oh, so that means you've all been to Chincoteague. Chincoteague is on the eastern shore of Virginia. Yeah. And how many of you have ancestors who were at Jamestown? Just one? Two, okay. Oh, okay. I was hoping some of you all had ancestors. How many of you think you might have ancestors at Jamestown? Have you all traced your ancestors back 400 years and know they were not at Jamestown? You know they were not at Jamestown. None of your dead ends that you have. Well, this for most of you, this is just going to be a rhetorical commercial because I'm going to talk about Jamestown.
Maybe
you can live again. So it's only one here from Jamestown. Are you a member of the Jamestown Society?
I am not.
Okay. I was going to ask if you were a member of Organization of First Families of Virginia or of Ancient Planners, so I guess there's no need to spend any time on that. And so my last question to figure out what you all know about the Eastern Shore is, what's the Eastern Shore most famous for? And you've been there. The ponies. You know, the Eastern Shore. Chincoteague ponies. Yeah. Okay. Y'all have the handout. I'm going to refer to it several times. I was thinking back to the days when Dick Cleveland and Paul Lawrence and I were talking. Every once in a while we'd say, you know, we're tired of hearing just about how the software works. Let's talk about history or genealogy a little bit. And we'd arrange for somebody to come in and just talk about history and genealogy. So when Bob Epp said, I'd like for you to come up and talk to the Roots user group. See, I still call it the Roots user group. Rug. I guess now you just sort of call it Rug. I'm thinking, well, I'm really, I just use this software so that I can generate my web page and do my genealogy. At one time, I thought some of the people in the Rug were more into the actual computer than they were into the genealogy. And I recently taught a genealogy class for about 25 people every Wednesday night for 6 weeks. It was 2 hours, so it was, you know, 12-hour course. And they all wanted to know, if they were just starting out, what software would I recommend? And I went, there's a web page called the Top 10 Genealogy Software Programs. And of course, I guess it's maybe Ancestry.com sponsors it because, you know, Family Tree Maker is number one, of course. But Reunion is number two. And TMG is usually number six or seven. Depends on what year and what they're comparing it to. And when you look at all the scores they make, TMG matches everybody above it except in one box. It just says one box. It does not get a check mark. And what do you think that is? User friendly. And I had sort of forgot that because I use it so much. I think it works fine. I don't have a good problem with it. But after seeing the presentation this morning, I'm thinking, you know what? It's really not user friendly, is it? It's too complicated. It has too many options, you know. It's like it's got 1,000 options, and each one of them has a pull down menu. And, you know, I wish it had 10 options, you know. So I'm going to talk a little bit about TMG, but probably not as much as you want. So what I'm going to do here, I'm going to use a bunch of different softwares. I'm going to start out with that Eastern Shore timeline that I passed out. Got to make this bigger. And I'm not going to read this to you. I'm just going to tell you about how things started. For those of you, since only one of you from Jamestown lines maybe don't understand, Jamestown was started in 1607. That's when they first set foot on Jamestown Island. 400 years later, in 2007, they had a 400-year anniversary, and there was a lot of emphasis on Jamestown and the Jamestown families and things like that. In 1608, Captain John Smith left Jamestown and sailed up the Chesapeake Bay. Like I say, I'm giving this to you so you can take it home and read it. But I do have to hit a couple of things here. Two of the prominent citizens of Jamestown who ended up on the Eastern Shore were Sir George Yardley, the colonial governor, and Ensign Thomas Savage, who was an interpreter with the Indians. Ensign Thomas Savage went over to the Eastern Shore very early, like 1622. He got a 9,000 acre grant, not only from the colony, but also from the Indians there. Sir George Yardley was over there, and in 1622, he got about a 3,000 acre grant over there. 1624, the Virginia Company, who settled Virginia, they were in a lot of trouble, so they sort of went belly up, as you might say today, and went bankrupt, and the King of England took over, and Virginia became England's first royal colony. So at that time, they did an inventory of what they had, and they transferred from, you know, the Virginia Company to the crown. Some other things is in six plant for genealogists. In 1632, the oldest continuous English-speaking records in America began on the eastern shore of Virginia. They're still there. When I taught the genealogy course, I took the students down to the East Coast Courthouse. We opened up record book number one, which has been preserved, and they could touch it. It's been, the pages are now sandwiched in plastic or something. So anyway, it is amazing to go over there, and I try to do my research over there instead of off of microfilm, instead of off of Ancestry.com. I just get a certain feeling about opening up a 300-year book and looking at the actual type, the actual handwritten language. So, not a lot of interesting things. No wars over there. Most things passed us by. But this is a map of the Eastern Shore. Norfolk is down here. The bridge tunnel brings you over and up into the lower county, which is called Northampton. The upper county is called Accomack. Just about the time you get almost to Maryland up here, and for those of you who've been to Chincoteague or Chincoteague Island, well, right across Chincoteague Island is on the seaside, and we actually call the Eastern Shore Bayside Seaside. The old records going back 300 years will say, you know, John Smith Seaside, John Smith Bayside. If there were two people with the same name, they had to distinguish between them in the record, they'd call one BS and SS. And that wasn't bullshit, it was Bayside. It's funny to see. For first people who don't see that, they see somebody's name and they go, BS. But anyway, my little town of Saxons is right here, and that little harbor that you were looking at is right there. So at one time, the Maryland, Virginia line sort of kept straight right through here, and Saxons would have been in Maryland. Thank God it's in Virginia. I don't know why I say that, but we've always thought Virginia was better than Maryland. Tangier Island. How many have been to Tangier Island? That's a nice little trip. You just ride down to Reedville and catch a ferry, a person ferry, not your car, and take it out to Tangier and have crab cakes for lunch during the summer. No cars on Tangier, just golf carts. The next part of the handout talks about, well, I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit. Let me go back now to I've got a lot of stuff to show you. Let me run through this little PowerPoint here. Some of the things I just said might be duplicates. So, they left Jamestown in 1608. Captain John Smith decided to take a trip around the Chesapeake Bay and see what was here. Now, you remember when they first got to Jamestown, they were still looking for gold, and they were still looking for a route to the West Indies and wealth and to get all the way around the world. So they were hoping one of these rivers was going to lead them all the way into the to Japan, but it didn't. So his first trip, 1608, he comes up the eastern shore, loops in and out, and right here, he literally runs right beside Saxon Island up the Pocomoke River and comes back out, finishes his trip around the eastern shore, around the Chesapeake Bay. So Captain John Smith came within inches of Saxon Island in 1608. There was, once they realized that they needed salt to preserve their food at Jamestown, they came back out here on the barrier islands of the eastern shore and set up a salt works in 1614. It ran about 3 years. What they were doing is, it's about a 5 or 6 foot range of tide out there. So what they would do is, when the tide dropped 5 feet, they were collecting up the salt from the salt work. That's what a salt work was all about. Accomack Plantation was set up in 1620. Ensign Thomas Savage got his land grant in 1622. Sir George Yardley got his land grant in 1622 as well. Sir George Yardley was the colonial governor in 1619. He's the one who set up the House of Burgesses, which was the first representative government in America. Now, some of this I give for my granddaughter's fourth grade history class. This colonial home called Oak Grove is on Sir George Yardley's land patent. It wasn't his home, it's not that old. This only goes back to the early, about 1720, one of the older sections here. But it's on Sir George Yardley's original 370-acre land patent. The oldest part of this house was probably built about 1725, and it's the small section here. This is where they built homes on the eastern shore of Virginia. They started out with a small house. If they were successful, they would just start adding on to the other ends of the house. So about every 20 years, another room is added, another wing is added. So this is the way Oak Grove looks today. That's the part built, the original part. Now, the reason my granddaughter, Samantha Reagan, in fourth grade Virginia history, they were studying Virginia history, and they mentioned something about Jamestown, and she said to the teacher, "My granddad knows all about that." And so the teacher said, "Tell your granddad to come in and talk to us." So a month later, I had to do a presentation, and you're looking at part of it right here. So this is what's interesting about why my granddaughter knows about Sir George Arthur. You know what's going to happen here, don't you? You already know, right? That's me and my wife, Linda. That's my daughter, Becky, and her husband, Mike. And that's my granddaughter, Samantha. I don't know if you can see it from out there, but if Sir George Arley is number one, Samantha's in the 15th generation of descent. So more about the Eastern Shore. Oldest court records in America, right there at the Eastville Courthouse. Any Presbyterians in the group? Oh. Ooh, a hand is raised. Do you know who started the Presbyterian religion in America? If you don't, read this room real fast. Reverend Francis McKimmy was bowled over from Ireland by Colonel William Stevens of Pocomoke of Maryland and asked to set up a Presbyterian church. And he was right there, not far from Thaxton Island, is where he's buried. And there's a little group called the Francis McKimmy Society who's trying to preserve his gravesite. The British troops came in the Revolution and occupied some of the creeks and basically used the Eastern Shore for supplies. Now, what is really interesting, the War of 1812, the British troops camped out on Tangier Isle before attacking Fort McHenry in Baltimore. Thousands of them were there. All the ships were there. And we have this sort of famous local Methodist minister over there named Joshua Thomas. He spoke to the British troops the night before they invaded Baltimore and told them that God had told them that they would not be successful. So if you're a Methodist, that's a great story. We had one governor of Virginia from the Eastern Shore, Governor Wise, who was born on the Eastern Shore right before the Civil War. Like I said, there were no battles on the Eastern Shore during the Civil War, but the Union troops did occupy the Eastern Shore because most people don't realize this, but there was a telegraph line between Washington, D.C., and Fort Monroe, Virginia. You know where Fort Monroe, Virginia is? Down in the Hampton area. Have you ever noticed when you drive by there, it's got a moat around it, and the Chamberlain Hotel is on it, so, and you can stay at the Chamberlain Hotel. So when the Civil War broke out, the Union troops had a general stationed at Fort Monroe, which is part of the American Army. And so the telegraph line was run from Washington down the Eastern Shore, laid under the Chesapeake Bay, over to Fort Monroe, so Lincoln could stay in constant contact with whoever the general was at Fort Monroe throughout the Civil War. So for those Virginia history buffs, what famous battle took place right off of Fort Monroe? In Hampton Roads. The Monitor and the Merrimack, right. Now, here's a little piece of history that also there, after the Civil War, the Custis family's Arlington House plantation was taken by the Union Army and became Arlington National Cemetery. So Arlington National Cemetery is named after the Custis family who had a plantation down here early in the 1700s, the wealthy Dutch planters. That's where they first settled. The fourth, John Custis, married Martha. No, you're supposed to help me. Martha who? Dandridge. He died. She had two children. She married George Washington. Right. One of Martha's children left descendants who married Robert E. Lee. And so Robert E. Lee was living at Arlington in the Civil War started. Robert E. Lee did not own Arlington. His wife did.
They took it.
They took it. Right. Okay, well, we talked about Missy of Chincoteague, probably the most famous thing on it. And we also have, right up there near Chincoteague, there's a place called Wallops Island where NASA has a launch facility now. And they're going to start launching more. Now that the space shuttle is over, they're going to start doing more launches from NASA. Bridgetown came in 1964. It's about 17 miles long. It's a beautiful trip across the Chesapeake Bay, the entrance there. So you're going to get, like I said, you're going to get some history today, whether you like it or not. Trying to keep on my schedule here. I'm probably not going to be real interested in this one, but I'm going to do it anyway. But it won't take long. As I mentioned earlier, this is how Jamestown got started. In 1624, the London Company, or the Virginia Company of London, sort of gave up and the Crown took it over. But what they did in 1624 was, when the Crown took it over, they did an inventory, a muster, a census of what the Crown is now going to take over. So that's when they did a census of everyone living in Virginia in 1624. If that census and that list of names they call the muster of 1624, if you have ancestors that you can trace back who were on that muster, then you qualify for membership as the first family of Virginia, or an ancient planter, or in some cases, the Jamestown Society. So what I wanted to just show you now is how these three, if you're into joining societies, I have to admit I'm part of the Jamestown Society. An older cousin of mine talked me into it. He said, I paid the registration fee. All you got to do is fill out the paperwork. So I did. But the earliest ones, the ancient planters, were actually in Jamestown and had actually moved out of Jamestown. And they were on a plantation of their own by 1616. That's why they're called ancient planters. Now, all these folks are documented in a book called... in several books. I'll show you the book in a minute. So from the eastern shore of Virginia, we have these six ancient planters who were there. This is the years, the ships they came in on, and the years they were born, and the year they came in. So Henry Bagwell was the first clerk of court. Francis Mason actually didn't reside on the eastern shore, but his daughter Anne married John Kendall, whose family's on the eastern shore. Ensign Thomas Savage. Some people call the Savage family the oldest family in America because they still have male line descendants living today named Savage that can trace themselves back. Ensign Thomas Savage came over in 1608 on the same boat with Captain Christopher Newport. Who's Newport? There's a college down in Newport News. Yeah. Christopher Newport. And of course, Sir George Orley is my claim to fame. So he came over in 1610. Now the next group is called the Orders of First Families of Virginia. They were here when that census was taken in 1624, but they necessarily were not moved out onto those plantations. So this is sort of like the second tier of people. Now this Order of First Families of Virginia, often called OFFV, if you're into acronyms, they commissioned a book called Adventures of First in Person, Virginia, 1607 to 1624. It's now in the fourth edition. The first version came out in like the 1950s. The fourth edition was done for the 400th anniversary of Jamestown. So what they did for the fourth edition was they expanded it from one volume to three volumes. Each volume has 700 or 800 pages. It's over 2,000 pages. And the objective was to trace all the descendants for six generations from Jamestown, which takes them up to about the Revolutionary War. And that piece of monumental genealogy work was done by a guy I can now call my friend, John Frederick Dorman, who lives in Stafford County, about 10 miles from me. And he says he doesn't do talks anymore. I've asked him several times. He's about 85. He's still doing genealogy, though. I went to see him about a year ago, and I said, what do you use your computer for? He said, I use WordPerfect. He said, I typed those 2,000 pages in WordPerfect. And I said, so you don't use a genealogy program? And I don't want to, he said. I don't like the constraints. I like to just do it the way I like to do it. So I said, what do you think of the internet? He said, it's terrible. I said, but hey, if you look at Ancestry.com, he says, people tell me it's a lot of mistakes on Ancestry.com. So I sit down at his computer. Now, this guy's 85 years old. He also did the, not only did he do this set of books, but also he did the Virginia Genealogist for 50 years, which is a set of magazines that came out three times a year. And he lived in downtown D.C. somewhere for most of his life. He said, what can you show me? So I used my Ancestry.com logon and password, logged into it, and I pulled up a census record of him, because he's 85, he's in the census. And I said, he goes like Fred. I said, Fred, do you realize that all the census images are on Ancestry.com? And I said, there's no mistakes in them. Look at them. You're looking at the census taker's handwriting. He said, really? He said, I want to find somebody named Slaughter. So we found it. And he said, don't touch the computer. I said, what are you going to do? I said, we'll save this image off to a thumb drive or to your hard drive. He said, no. And he got his pencil and pad of paper. He started writing it down. 6 months later, I went back to see Fred Dorman. And I said, Fred, are you still using Ancestry.com? He said, first thing in the morning, the last thing at night. Census records. That's all he trusted for. So the Jamestown Society, so if you have families that were in Virginia by 1624, you can qualify for any of these organizations. But the Jamestown Society is probably the largest of the group. I think they wanted to just expand their membership, so they decided that since the colonial capital of Virginia was in Jamestown until 1699, when they moved it to
Williamsburg.
And then it later moved to
Richmond.
All right. But it was in Jamestown in 1699, so they decided that if you had an ancestor who was in the House of Burgesses, then he must have came to Jamestown for a few weeks every year. So he lived at Jamestown for a while. So you could qualify for the Jamestown Society. So now instead of having a few hundred members, now they have thousands of members, because more people, you can just imagine. It expands the gene pool if you can trace anybody back who was in the House of Burgesses up until 1699. The Eastern Shore of Virginia, again. The Jamestown Society members, if you had any of these folks to be your ancestor. So you can see there's 51 qualifying ancestors for the Jamestown Society. So most folks from the Eastern Shore of Virginia can easily qualify for the Jamestown Society. Although probably 99% of them never heard of it and don't really care. These books I was talking about, and you were talking about sources, and I'm thinking, what do you call it? Bundle? Grouping?
Lumping.
Listen, it's the only way to go. It's the only way to go. So this particular book, Cavaliers and Pioneers of Land Patents, I've probably used it 100 times, so I just have one source for this book, and after I click on that one source, then I just go down to the text or the memo that goes with it and type in page 12, paren, land grant of so-and-so. This is Mr. Dorman's book, Adventures of First in Person. So what I have done is I have loaded, he's got about 3,000 or 4,000 people in here from the Eastern Shore of Virginia in those first six generations. I've loaded them all into the Myers files. I'll show you a little bit of that later. This is a book on Sir George Yardley. My high school librarian wrote that book, and that's a copy she gave my wife. The Eastern Shore of Virginia has lots and lots of books in print about the history and genealogy of the Eastern Shore. Ralph Whitehall did a two-volume set of books, 1,300 pages. He traced most of the land patents from the beginning patent up to about 1800. He did that in 1950. All the wills in Northampton County from 1632 to 1802 are in a book. It's just amazing resources. The wills in Accomack County from when it was founded in 1663 to 1800 are in a book. Yes, that's me right there. My cousin and I picked up and did a book from 1800 to 1860. That only took 2 years of our life. Marriages in Northampton County from the beginning up to about 1854. Another marriage is in Accomack County. So these books just sort of, there's another book my cousin and I did on Accomack County marriages. Graveyards. There's three gravestone books over there. Each one has about 15,000 gravestones in it, 45,000 gravestones. And most of these graves are out on farms, out in marshes, out in the woods, hard to find. So you're so glad that somebody went through them some 50 years ago and wrote them all down. There's even a webpage now over there where there's 24,000 tombstone pictures online. The people starting to now take the photos and put them online. That's a tombstone book Mary Frances Carey and I did. I went to see this lady and I said, I hear you're going to do a tombstone book. And she says, I hate to type. I said, what does that mean? She said, I'm not doing a book. I said, well, how many tombstone records do you have? She said, 11,000. I said, well, where are they? She said, they're in those card files right there. So she had these little card file drawers you pull out like you have in the library when they're using card files, 11,000 of them. I said, can I type these and we'll make a book? She said, well, you're going to spend a lot of time on my kitchen table, aren't you? So I took my laptop in there and I stacked the cards out and I typed them. So after about four trips to the Eastern Shore, you know, I typed 1,000 of them. I said, Mary Frances, this is going to take forever. I found out later, now she's like 85 years old. She was really doing that so I would come and visit her. And I said, you know, we've been doing this for a year and I've only got 1,000. I said, this race is going to take 11 years. And she said, well, you just need to come more often. So finally she let me take a whole drawer of them over to my Eastern Shore house where I lived at Saxon. By the way, I lived in Northern Virginia from 1980 to still today. We just visit the Eastern Shore. So eventually by letting them carry them over to my Saxon house a few years later, we finally got them all tight. And I said, Mary Frances, you didn't do any of the black cemeteries. Why would I? She said. She said, I'm not related to any of them. I said, no, but we're going to be really criticized if we put a tombstone book out and we don't include the blacks. She said, well, I'm not doing them. I said, well, I guess my cousin and I were doing them. So we added a few thousand more black cemeteries and finally got the book published. Now, the odd thing about this book is, she said, now, you're going to mess up if you put those white carvings and those black carvings, if you do the book in alphabetical order, and they're all going to be in there together, it's going to confuse people. I said, so what do you want to do with the black ones? She said, put them in the back, just like the back of the bus. So we did. Otherwise, she wouldn't let me print the book. More books about certificates are these things that were for patent, head rights, and tax lists are in print. Land causes, y'all know what a land cause is? Maybe this only occurred in Virginia, or maybe it only occurred on the Eastern Shore. But a land cause is when somebody, most of the time, someone died without a will. And they had trouble settling the will and dividing up the land and who owned the land and stuff like that. And how it would be divided among the children or the stepchildren or the children from two wives and all that kind of stuff. So anytime there was a land dispute on who owned the land, there's a separate set of books over there in the clerk's office. They got will books, deed books, order books, and they have land calls books. So it's a series of books. And this guy typed them all from 1728 when they started up to 1825. So some of these land causes give you three or four generations of descent and tell you who's descended of who, because if 20 years after someone died, they're still arguing about who owned the land, now grandchildren come in for a share, and it talks about all of them. Soldiers and sailors, the same thing happened somewhere around 1835, the federal government finally was substantial enough that it could award bounty land for being in the Revolutionary War. And people just lined up like crazy at the courthouse to sign up for, if the pensioner himself was dead, they say the heirs of so-and-so who was in the Virginia militia or on the galley, the Accomack, his living heirs are in to list them all. Grandchildren, all these people. So, and some of the greatest ones are when the person himself had no children. So now they're listing all the descendants of his brothers and sisters. This is just wonderful stuff for genealogy. Before Ancestry.com came, we actually put the census books in print for the counties over there. So there's a lot of books in print over there, so that's why I'm a lumper when it comes to doing sources. Okay, so now we're finally up to the point where we're going to talk about TMG. Do I have until what time?
Noon.
Oh, okay. This is one person in TMG I have, but what I want to show you first is I will just show you my my project summary so you get an idea of what we're dealing with here. 74,000 names, which I used to think was a lot until I talked to some people who say that's not so bad. I know one guy's got 140 and another's got 210,000. The guy with the 210,000 is using both of those guys, 140 and 210, they're both using Family Tree Maker. Events, this is where I start to show off a little bit. I got 200,000 events for only 74,000 people. So it's at least three events per person, but as you can see on this screen below me, it's not an average. Some of them only have birth and death. Some of them only have birth, so others have 20 or 30. Relationship citations, 246 citations, 246,000. Sources, 2,051 sources. And I'll show you some of that a little bit here in a minute.
And you're a lumper.
And I'm a lumper. Yes. See, if I did it individually, how many citations did I say I had?
200.
You got to have 246,000 sources. You can't. You just can't deal with it. Sheer numbers make you do some things. So what I've been doing, let me give you a little background here. I watched the TV show Roots in 1977, 78. You know, and I said, if that guy can trace his ancestry, so can a poor boy from Texas, Virginia. So I talked to my mom, and she loved it. I talked to my dad, and he said, let's watch Gunsmoke. And so I talked to my mom so much, when we start talking, he said, can you all take that in the other room? I got to watch Gunsmoke. Well, the interesting thing is, later I found out that it's my mom line, my mom's lines that go to Jamestown. She didn't know that. She had no idea. And Dad, I would come back to Dad once in a while and I'd say, now your grandmother Susan, he says, what do you want to know about Grandma Susan? I said, well, I can't seem to find her parents in the census. You never will, he said. She's a love child. 30 years later, I still don't know who her father is. So, he was right. So I've been working on genealogy since 78, and that's why we have 74,000 names in here. I did my genealogy back, you know, as far as I could. My wife at first, my wife is from
a little... We lost the screen for some reason or other. This is the projector. Yep.
It just decided to time out. You unplugged it?
Yeah.
Just when they get to see my sources. Power's off. I mean, it's just like, no, I don't.
You can't get one.
I think I'm on battery.
Yeah, I'm on battery.
Oh, the exit light's on, but that's all I see. This thing's running on the battery, so I guess. See, my laptop's just running off the battery.
Yeah, mine's switching
battery. This light's on. This great. There, I see a green light on.
It's been on all the time. Green light's been on.
Yeah. So what are you still into?
Mine is now on battery, too. I'm plugging it down here.
Which he is plugged in.
There's another
computer.
Here.
It's completely
in.
So let me just show you a little bit about what I do with Family Tree Maker. William Burton, tall gentleman, came from England. And so here's the list of events. So you realize here that, you know, let's just say I've got 20 there, and 20 more there, and 10 more down there. So let's say I got 50 events for William Burton, gentleman, born in England. 1643, according to one book I have, he was descended from so-and-so, and he's something about his English roots. Most of the time, I do not do the English roots unless it leads to royalty. So I'm basically interested in finding the first Americans. Anyway, you can see the kinds of things I type in. I do a lot of typing. And you see over here, it says, this is the source column. So if I click on this, you'll see the source came from this book by McCurdy on William Burton. So, and I didn't put a page number on that. I'm sorry. Let's see this one. This one came from Edwards and McCurdy. So there's a book called Ames, Mears, and Allied Lines. So this came from page 41 to 45 of the Burton family. She's got like five pages in there on the Burton family. So that's how I source and reference her material. Now, if you look at my master source list. Well, this is going to bring up the 2,100 and whatever it is. So this is an alphabetical order by the author for the most part. I started out with my grandfather's Bible. It's source number 2. I used it 41 times. Here's a will book for Somerset County. It was my 2,160th source I've entered. I've already used it, and I've just started in the Worcester County. I've already used it 324 times. Some of these get, you can see some of them are barely used, and some of them are used 600-700 times. I think there's a couple on here. Here's Stratton Nottingham's books. Stratton Nottingham died in 1932. He lived in Nantucket. He was a genealogist. There was a... I'm looking at my clock. I got time to divert and tell you some of these little stories. A lady from the Eastern Shore named Henrietta Ayers married a shoemaker from North Carolina. She met him in Baltimore, and he became the co-founder of the Hanover Shoe Company in Hanover, Pennsylvania. So as it turns out, Henrietta had this strong interest in Eastern Shore genealogy, and she became wealthy. So she decided to devote her life to Eastern Shore genealogy, and she had plenty of money. So what she did was, she actually had a home built next door to the Accomack County Courthouse and Clerk's Office, and when she was down there, she could work next door. She modeled it after a colonial plantation home on the Eastern Shore, and now that house is open on Garden Route because it's a wonderful model of a colonial home. When she died, she left it to one of her first cousins. Plenty of money. And I talked to that cousin of hers, nephew, and he said, yeah, Henrietta, he said, the Hanover Shoe Company never ran out of money. She had two corresponding secretaries, and she traveled the world. She was a member of every genealogy society known to man. She died in 1960, and her books had not yet been put in print. So someone in the family kept working on those books and put them in print. It was a 3-volume set. Each one had 700 pages. Again, it was about 2,000 pages of genealogy of Eastern Shore ancestors. So what she did was she hired genealogists to go into the courthouses all over England, Virginia, wherever she needed to do the resource, to do the research. So she started this about 1920. She died in 1960. She worked on it 40 years. She hired a guy in Accomack County named Stratton Nottingham to go into the Accomack and Northampton courthouses and start looking up every instance of certain names like Ayers or Drummond or whoever her ancestors were. So Nottingham spent a lot of time in courthouses working for her. So then he ended up making one of these books called Wills and Administrations of Accomack County, 1663 to 1800. I've used that book 23,000 times. And I am not through, by no means. The book is torn up now. The cover's come off. And I've got it spiral bound. But what I'm doing is I'm making notes in there. And every person that's named in a will that gets into my database, I put a check mark beside their name. So right now I probably have half the names in the book check mark. I've got to do the other half. I mean, I should quit right now and go home and get started. But you can see why I'm a lumper here. Because, you know, I've used that one book 23,000 times. So, well, that's what she called it. I've never heard of that word before. This particular guy, there was a little story about where he came from England. Then he was a headwright. Y'all know what a headwright is?
Mm-hmm.
Everybody knows what a headwright is? Okay. To start this Virginia company, to get people to come into the colony, to sell the colony, they were giving away land. So they had plenty of land. They just took it from the Indians. And so what they would do is, if you could pay for the transportation of, let's say, 10 people to come over, like you came and brought 9 people with you, so it's 10 of you coming over, and you could pay passage for the ship fees and everything to get over there. When you got to Virginia, you went down and certified to court or clerk or whoever, someone from the colony, that you brought 10 people in, you listed their names. And then they were going to issue you a certificate for 10 times 50 for 500 acres of land. Then you took that certificate to the patent office and they issued you a land patent for 500 acres. And then the local surveyor, the surveyor of the colony, would walk with you wherever, you know, what's not been taken. So you might want that 500 acres on the creek or that 500 acres over there. So you were the patentee of the land. You patented the 500 acres. A land patent is the first issue of land. After that, it just deeds of transfer. And there's other 9 people who were on that land patent with you are called headwrights. Their head was counted to give you the right to the 500 acres. So they're called headwrights. So all these people had to be documented. So these are tremendous source of names of early immigrants, either as a patentee or as a headwright. So in this case, usually when you see somebody as a headwright in 1660, it was on this date that a land certificate was granted to John Wilcox for 1,000 acres, transporting 20 persons into the colony, and among them was William Burton. And I listed the other names on the patent with him. So what we know is he was here by 1660 because he's on a headwright list. Now, the headwright list usually took a while. Some of these guys, if they only brought over 3 or 4 people, they didn't want to go get a patent for 150 acres. They would wait until they got more people, so they could get much larger patents, like 1,000. So he may have collected more people over for a year or two and collected these names so that he could get a larger patent. So if you're a headwright in 1660, you might have come in 1, 2, or even 3 years before that. So what I'm trying to do is tabulate his first record in America, and that's probably it when he first made the headwright list. Then he was on the taxable list in 1662, the titable list, we called it then. And do y'all use this event called Antidote?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's the greatest one of all because it's free form. You can do whatever you want with it in terms of structure. So in January of 1665, he was selling cattle to Mary Cole in Northampton County. So I didn't want to create a special event for selling cattle. But as you go through here, you see I'm picking him up on the title list. I'm picking him up when his marriage occurs down in here. I tried to pick up all the land bought and sold and all the wills. So if you look on that handout I gave you, then on page 5, I'm going to show you the sort of things I've done in PMG. So that I can do what I'm trying to do here with this Eastern Shore genealogy. First, I could show you the text macros. You all use text macros? What? No? My God. You're kidding. Nobody in this room uses text macros?
No. Not in PMG.
Good God.
That's why we have, that's why we got you.
Yes, I'm going to actually show
you. Well, you're
going to
have to do another presentation on how
to. Yes, okay, I'll do it right now. Under tools, you see that? Under tools, see text macros? Okay, you get to use, you get 12 of them. Shift F2 through Shift F12. They're the ones I've used right there. I'll put them here in the handout. And you might go, why did you come up with things like that? Well, you know, when you have an event, you want something to follow the event that ties in with it. I don't put a lot of words in the event structure, but I have created, you know, I have about 200 custom events that I use over and over again. That's what I was getting ready to show you. But I'm trying to see if I got one here. Okay, here's a lamb pattern, for instance. Okay. This William Burton patented land in 1677 in Sussex County, Delaware, and it came from the Sussex County, Delaware patent book, Folio 79. That's back when they used stage-end folios. So the sentence structure goes like this. This is all that's in the actual TMG. When I click on patented land, it just says patented land. It's just going to show his name, the words patented land, and the date and location, followed by a memo. Right? Y'all familiar with this part, right? So it's when I get ready to type the memo that I try to make the memo follow on in a sort of a readable way from the event. So I found out what I was doing was I was starting many of my memos was it was on this date that his first grant of land in Delaware, you know, something like, I was typing in, it was on this date. So I said, okay, text macro, it was on this date. So when you look at the sentence here, it says, William Burton one gentleman patented land so-and-so in Sussex County, Delaware. It was on this date that his first patent of land in the Delaware region. So it's just to sort of carry you into. So that's why I made those 12 text macros there. Some of them are very short. The third one is just five dashes with brackets around it, which is what I do not use name unknown. What is it most people use? I hate it. Mm-hmm. Last name. Some people put three little digits in there if they don't know the last name. Yeah, UNK or something like that. If I don't know their name, I'll put their name in dashes. I'll show you. See this one here? Well, see that? So I'm typing in that a lot, so I just have a macro for that. So when I'm getting ready to type in a name, I just hit Shift F4, Shift F4, saves me. Those text macros save a tremendous amount of time. You got to remember, I'm sitting there with all these books around me. I can load data till the cows come home. Bye-bye. So that's why I created some of these shortcuts. It's also interested in looking at that name list. I'll divert here a minute. You end up with, let's take the Burton guy. Why could they not be a little more creative with these names? Right, look at that. All is William Burton. So sometimes you use BS and C-side and Bayside, and sometimes you use gentlemen, and sometimes you use initials, and sometimes you use Roman numerals. You gotta have somebody to keep these guys apart. I got some worse cases than that. But anyway, those text macros I think are very helpful. I want to also show you my source list. I want to go back to that. I showed you that a minute ago. But I put most of the census records up here in the numbers block, just, you know, 1800, 1792, whatever. Now, so what I have done is I'm using the Accomack County, I'm in the Accomack County clerk's office a lot. Now that I'm retired, I'm in it. When I'm on the Eastern Shore, I spend 2 days out of every week in the clerk's office. Like I said, I like to use the old records. So this is the Accomack County records book sequence here. A couple of these are out of sequence, but once we started here into like the deeds and wills and the deeds number books, so you see I have this whole string of Accomack County records here that I used. So what I did was I made one list of every record book in Accomack County and entered them as a source. Now you see some of them over here have not been used very many times, but they're there in sequence so that I don't have to re-enter them. And so you see some of them I've started to use a little bit more than others. But I have the same thing. There's all the Accomack County married registers, the order books. You know, like I say, I live in the Accomack clerk's office, the will books. So the same thing happens when you get down to Northampton County. I spent a lot of time in the same thing. Here's the Northampton County clerk's office book name, all loaded in here. Another one back up to Accomack. Now we have some people that are, now I've done, me and my cousin did about five books, marriages, tombstones, and will books and things like that. But this lady here, McKee, Joanne Riley McKee, her ancestor was in Accomack County in 1660, Riley. So she's taken the Accomack County, you know what an order book is? So what happens is, when you go into court and have all these cases, the clerk of the court's in there writing down what happened in the court that day. And he goes back and records it in what they call order books. So in Accomack County, you have deed books for land transfers, you have will books, and you have order books. These are the three main streams of records. So the order books are just what happened in court that day. But they're sort of great because, you know, what they were doing early on, they're bringing in women and charging them for fornication and bastard bearing, and then some guy's got to pay the fine. You go, God, he's a real father, maybe, we don't know. So it's a lot of interest in spending these order books. So what this lady has done, she has transcribed the Accomack County order books from 1663 up to about 1763, where she is now. So she's done 19 volumes of them. So that's why I have her whole block there like that. There's another lady who's crazier than she is. Gail Walschek. I hope Gail lives forever, too. Gail, here's her collection. And she jumps around a lot. She's done orphan accounts, possession of returns. Y'all know what possession of returns are? So if I have to come back and talk about it.
We'll just keep it running.
Possession of returns, I don't know if they did this in all states or all counties, but early on, to keep the landowners from arguing about the property lines, the county would order the vestry, four members of the vestry, to go out and walk the property lines. So what they would do is, and your lines were walked once every 4 years. They try to get around the county once every 4 years, every property line. So they would get the property owners on both sides of the fence out there, and the members of the vestry would say, "Now, George, that's your line. You agree?" And this guy would say, "Sam, that should get your grade." So they would record it. They walked around and they recorded what they saw, who was there, and what lines they agreed to. So this is a tremendous source for genealogy information. And for land, if you're trying to figure out where somebody owned and where somebody didn't own. So they were called, since these people were out possessing, who possessed the land? They were out doing the possessioners, they were possessioners, so they were called possessioner returns. So these books are just a tremendous amount of detail. Unfortunately, the clerk did not index them or put page numbers on them. So they're pretty worthless when you go down there and just open up a book of 600 pages, and it's just people walking lines, name after name after name. It's like, wow. So Gail decided a few years ago, so she transcribed at least two of them, and she's done some more of them since then. So Gail has done 93 Accomack and Northampton County record books, transcribed them. So there's her Northampton County series there, too. So we're fortunate to have tons and tons of information already organized. Okay, events.
Excuse me. Yeah. Am
I right that in your sources, in some cases, you identify the county and type of book, and in other cases, you identify the author?
Yes. They're both in there. It's just a matter of how I chose to put for the first item, so that's how it would index. All the authors are actually in here in author name. That county set of books you were looking at, I didn't put in an author. They're the county record books. I guess, I sort of put in Accomack County Clerk's Office, but I've got them in order there so I can find them quickly. Yeah, the authors are all by the author. Yeah. All Gale's books came under Walshcheck, and all of McKee's books came under McKee. Yeah. But the actual clerk, court books, the actual hard books, these little books, the author, I think I just have them as Accomack County, in abbreviated Accomack County, so I could see it all. If I want to add an event to this list, I'm using most of the ones that, come out of the program, but I'm looking at my little list there of events in the handout on page 5. And I add them as I go because of when I find things. So if I find a record of a bastard child, usually I want to probably put in 3 things associated with that record. Either the child's name, if you can find a name, which often you don't. But the bastard of the father of the bastard child and the mother of the bastard child.
Do you give them a separate tag instead of as roles on them?
Yes. I never got the hang of that whole thing. The more I tried to use it back in UFT days, the more I got conflicts with it. It would show up where I didn't want it to show up, and it was printing out where I didn't want it to print out. So I did not. I don't use. In fact, I think I'm using the advanced version, but I really probably don't even need it. I am nowhere near using the full capability of these programs. And part of that was because I started in Roots 3, which had very limited capability. So by the time these programs came along, I'm sitting there with 40,000 and 50,000 names.
You're not going to redo it.
And I am not going to redo it. Somebody said, you need to redo it. And I said, yeah. No. Okay, so.
No.
So anyway, I have 3 events here. The bastard child, simply says, was named as a bastard child, a certain date, location, followed by a memory. And then the other one was going to say the father was named as the father of a bastard child. But a lot of times in these cases, when they drag these women into court, they actually force them to say who the father was. And then they draw the father into court to get him to admit it and pay the fine. Y'all familiar with what the vestry was doing there? Just like today, you're behind in your child support payments. This is what they were doing in the 60s.
So there's nothing in your sentence, though, that would tell who the bastard child was?
The P. So that's the person's name.
That's the father.
Right. The father would say, Joseph, in this case, it would say, William Burton was named as the father of a bastard child at a certain date, certain location. And then this one would say, Susie Smith. The P is the name of the person for the record, was named as the mother of the bastard child. So the mother's always named. The father is, sometimes she would say who the father was, sometimes she would say who she thought the father was. Somebody else would end up paying the fine. You're never sure if the person paying the fine was the father or the person who wanted to actually have that child work for them as a servant until they became of age. So sometimes the plantation owner was paying the fine simply because he just bought another servant for until they were 21.
It looks unique to Virginia, by the way.
Oh, is it?
Just doing a Google.
What, the... The church warden?
Or professions?
Oh, okay. That's good. Another thing which I started to use, I don't put it on the sheet there, but bound out. A lot of times the young men were bound out to learn a trade. So most of the time when you see that, it would be the person who's bound out to learn a trade, and then it would say, Susie Smith bound out her child. I've seen some cases where just write books about where they were bonding out with children because they couldn't afford to raise them.
The
you put more details in the memo.
Yeah, all the detail goes in the memo. I try to write these sound structures so that I can put the details over here. Otherwise, you know, you write a sentence and you think it fits, and then you come up with a situation and it just reads terrible. So I tried to make them as short as possible. And then write it in the memo. And that's why I have those little macros to say, it was on this date, that's it. And then that's where the details are. Census records. I remember I was doing this, and Dick Cleveland and everybody else said, you're just doing that wrong. And I said, okay, well, I'm just doing it, that's what I'm doing.
Oh, yeah, real splitting up tags.
Hundreds?
Three.
Oh, on census? So what I'm doing on census, so let me just tell you what I'm doing. Now, some of these are in here twice because something happened when I moved them from UFP over to TMG. They doubled up for some reason. I have a bunch of them in here twice. I just haven't bothered to merge them. But so I have something that says census head. Now, here's his name. Joe Smith was listed as the head of a household in the census of 1860 in Accomack County, then followed by a memo. The memo would say, he was shown as Joe Smith, 43-year-old farmer, living with him were the following. I put all that in if he's the head of the census. Now, if there's somebody in that household that doesn't seem to be related to him, it's going to say, William Burton was listed with Joseph Smith, another family in the census. Another family. I'm using that as I cannot identify the relationship, so I call it another family. If they're living with their brother, it says he was listed with his brother in the census. He was listed with his daughter. He was listed with his father-in-law. Most of them fall into this category. He was listed with his parents. What that does is if you break them up into these blocks, for me anyway, and there's a few more to go down here to uncle, when you look at someone's record here, if you can see, and I'm not on one right now, so sort of imagine with me here, if you can see 1850 is listed with his parents, 1860 is listed with his uncle. Uh-oh, parents, one of them's dead. Problem. 1880 is the head of a household. So it helps me track them through all the census records from when they're listed with somebody, like their parents, when they become the head of the household, when they leave the household. When somebody's living with somebody, it's probably their sister or their aunt and all that kind of stuff. It just helps me quickly look over here at the event tag and figure out what's going on. So that's the way I did the census records. Good, bad, or indifferent. I'm sticking to it.
Love to have your sentences. You could turn them into great
bowls. Yeah. Looking on the handout, I had this deed of gift. In Accomack County, a lot of people are giving cattle and land to people, so you have a deed of gift. Estate settlements are another one over there. You know, you not only do you have the will, but after you go to probate, or even if there's no will and there's administration, you get some fairly lengthy settlement statements where people are named. So I'll do the same thing there. I'll show it. So for settlements, the estate settlement is his estate settlement, the person. Joe Smith's estate was settled on a certain date, certain place, and then the sentence, what information I could gather out of that. And then it was named in the settlement of someone out of a relationship, or was named in his aunt's settlement of his aunt's estate or his father's estate or whatever. The more these little things you do and the more that you put here in this list here, and you see these dates where they were listed in all these things, it helps you to determine the relationships to other people. Now keep in mind, I am not doing my straight line to George Orton. I am doing what I call regional genealogy. I'm trying to take everybody in this county and plug them in somewhere. And that's why I'm doing it this way. Then if you look at the handout, you'll see fornication, guardian. Most of the time if you see guardian, you're looking up guardian bonds. Somebody chose a guardian, somebody was named as their guardian. Then I head right. The land is, to me, the land is, on the eastern shore, the land is like the last frontier. If you can't figure out how these people are related, and you start looking up at their deeds, and when they buy and sell this land, they'll say, "This is I'm selling the land." It's sort of like a chain of title. You have to say how you came to own this land, why you have the right to sell it. So, I'm selling the land that I got from my father when he died in you know, in Teste because he, I was the oldest son. And it's the land that was patented to him, you know, so many years earlier. So when they start telling about how they come to own this land, this genealogy, it's unbelievable. So a lot of these deeds that I come up with, I can do these things. Like somebody's named as adjoining landowner. Someone was named in a deed as owning land adjoining the land of so-and-so, a certain place and time. Land bought, land sold, there's the land calls. I was mentioned before, land certificate is just before you get a patent. I have the patents down here. Land owned, mortgages, exchange, just all kinds of things that come up in deeds that you can reference them and pull out and sort of build the structure of the region. Again, I'm doing regional genealogy, not just straight line genealogy. I do the same thing on obituaries. You know, if you get an obituary, you can type all night. If it names enough, survived by the following, you know. So, believe it or not, my cousin decided, he went through the local newspapers over there from 1881 to 1910. He did 30 years of obituaries. He looked at the microfilm and just typed them. And then he sent me a Microsoft Word file. 300 pages. He said, here, load them into the milestone. And then he said, I'm ahead of you, aren't I? I said, yep, you're years ahead of me. I said, look, I'm 63 and you're 73. I hope I outlive you. I hope I live as long as you do. So if you die at 80 and I do at 80, I get 10 years to catch up.
No, yes. You should publish that book for the obituary.
It's online at the Eastern Shore Public Library. Almost everything we do is on, I'll get to that in a minute. Everything we do is we try to put it online. So obituaries, orphan accounts, securities, you know, like you're a security on a marriage license or security on a state administration. The different tax things. And then the wills, I guess, are like, for me, the wills are the greatest ones of all. Highest priority in my terms, I start with the will books, do them first. So I'll have the will be the will of the person made a will on a certain day, was named in his aunt's will, was named in, and every time I come up with a new relationship here, I try to add it to the list here. So named in wills of everything from brother-in-laws to son-in-laws to great-grandfathers to great-uncles and all that kind of stuff. So you'll see here how I use that. So here's William Burton. He had, I don't know, seven or eight sons. And he had a lot of land, so he left a lot of stuff to him. So if we just take his first son here, William Burton. Now, I've got a lot of records on him here, but see, so he's first named in his father's will when he's 18 years old. You all got the age button up there, right?
Yeah.
Absolute requirement. Yeah. So he was first named in his father's will when he was 18, but then he was named in his father-in-law's will when he was 31. He was shown as my son-in-law, meaning stepson. You all got that right? They called them son-in-laws at first, but they really were stepsons. In the will of James Alexander, so his mother had remarried. And then he's listed in his mother's will, William Burton, in the will of Anne Alexander. She was also named. She also named his son William Burton, so she named her grandson. So I really try to pick up on these. Here's a good name, Woolsey Burton. Born in Accomack County. See, his name's in his father's will in 96, his father-in-law's will in 1709, then his mother's will in 1711, then brothers, some of his brothers died young, so they named him in their wills. So anytime that you can pick up a person and pick them up in their father's will, their mother's will, brother's will, sister's will, uncle's will, aunt's will, here's what happens. You think you got this thing absolutely right. And then you get an aunt who starts naming somebody, and it doesn't fit. My rule of thumb is everything must fit. Everything. If you get an aunt that says, I'm leaving my nephew somebody something, and you go, he's not really her nephew. Well, you look for this, maybe he was the husband of her niece or something like that. But if you can't get it to fit, your genealogy's wrong. You got to back out and start some other route. Everything has to fit. And that's why I have all these events in here, to try to be sure everything fits. Because a lot of times I'll assign somebody parents, and then a month later I'll go, no, wrong parents. Especially when you got a whole bunch of William Burtons and a whole bunch of sons of William Burtons. Okay, so that's the UFP thing. Let me show you on if you look at the handout, I'm not going to show you a second site so much. It's just I use the six. How many of you all use second site to make a web page? Okay. I use the six steps to second site, but I've added some details here because what I try to do is every time I update the page, I don't want to start over. It's too much to type. And let me start by showing you. We're not online in here, so I've got to go to.
You can.
That's all right. I got it on here somewhere. It looks close. So if you were online, I have another handout here, my business cards, so you can pick up my web page. This is what the last version of Miles files was like. I put out last December. I try to do it twice a year. Although I have 74,000 names in my database, only 63,000 are online because the other 10,000, 11,000 are still living. And the other thing I've tried to do with this web page is I've gone through John Frederick Young's books, First Families of Virginia, and all the ones from the Eastern Shore. I've tried to load in here, so I have loaded in 3,600 names. And I put his numbering system in parentheses inside my name so you can find out when you're tying back in with one of those families. I'll show you in a minute how that works. Problem, you get so many names, it's hard to. I'm looking for my name. Well, if you're recording this, it sounds bad, doesn't it? So I just picked a person here, sorry, at random. Bessie Hall, born in 1882. The little pop-up pedigree shows her parents and grandparents. What I did was I created descendant charts for all the first families of Virginia and all the House of Burgesses folks so that you can see at a glance that Bessie Hall is on, this is her father and mother, but she's on these following charts. So she's on, look at this, she's on three first families of Virginia charts. She's the descendants of Nicholas Granger, descendants of John Fisher, and the descendants of Henry Forrester. So, and you know how these work, right? You click on one of them, it'll take you to her name on that chart, right? And then you move back up the chart.
Betty is a male or
female? Female. Betty, nicknamed for Elizabeth.
Not
right,
but it's
male.
Said
what? This
one,
like Betty
married. Who's that one? Oh, really? It says he married. Yeah.
Oh. Yeah. You found a mistake, huh? No, the first line.
Oh, he married. Okay. Now let's see here.
So white?
That's when you're Christian.
Yeah, I'll have to check her out.
Good catch.
Yeah.
Now, I said Betty Ortoff, man. There might, this one might be a male. I can't.
Because Lindsay may be the one.
Right.
But right.
So anyway, when you click over on these charts, you know, he takes you to the family. Therefore, you know that a lot of people are looking to see if they might be First Families of Virginia or Jamestown Society. So this helps you tell at a glance whether you're going to fit into one of those categories or not. So, what I did was, using John Frederick Norman's book and other things I had, I picked out the ones from Accomack and Northampton County who were either in the House of Burgesses or First Families of Virginia. So you see this list here. So when I'm, so that's the list that I have here in Second Sight. And I try not to recreate all of those charts every time I do a new version of Second Sight. So some of these notes in here are just notes I took to myself so that I can pull up the database and just make changes to the last version of Second Sight and not start from scratch every time I want to update the model files on the line. So this Miles Files is, like I said, it's on the Eastern Shore Public Library's webpage. It's actually posted by the Library of Virginia in Richmond, is where I send the thumb drive every time I do an update there. And the people there in the IT department put me on to a Google web analysis of who uses the site. And for the last year or so, I'm getting about 150 hits a day. People are averaging about 12 minutes and downloading 15 pages every time they hit the site. I'm starting to get a tremendous amount of email now, you know, on a daily basis. You left out my great Aunt Mary, or you got my uncles, but you don't have my mom and dad. And I go, yeah, your mom and dad are still living, but your uncles and aunts are all dead. You know, but it's you know, it's what I do, so I feel like I have to sort of follow up with it and keep it going. But it is sort of a time consuming thing. Let's see where I was here. Okay, I'm getting down here now. I want to show you my daughter's. No, I say my daughter because this lady does me and my wife. For my daughter, who married a Reagan, it's funny, we moved to Washington, and my daughter married a Reagan, and his grandmother was a Bush. But not the Reagans or the Bushes. Yeah, I told everybody back home, I said, what are you doing? What's wrong with my daughter's wearing a Reagan? So this is my my daughter's pedigree chart. Thanks a lot for taping together. So after 40 years of research and after the TV show Roots, in the first 20 generations, I found that 1,000 of my daughter's ancestors, 11 of them are First Families of Virginia who were at Jamestown.
Wow.
And 3 of those lines go to European loyalty.
So which of your First Families of Virginia go back to?
So if you just drop down on that chart, I think I got a mark here in yellow. Grace Neal would be the first one that you come to, born 1603, and then John Wilkins. Now these are going to be Eastern Shore names, John Fisher. This George Nelville, fourth Lord of whatever that is.
Do you have any Parkers and Turners?
No Parkers or Turners.
Sure.
But anyway, let me see if I can pull up. So, so if you ever run into a Lady Elizabeth Gray,
yes. Yeah.
Okay, we're done. She has this, I mean, this is royalty city here. Look at everyone in name on there, everyone that's highlighted in there.
Well,
is
a
that's right. Yeah. So I brought with me, you know, just like I have her chart there. Here's the chart for George Melville and Lady Elizabeth Gray. Her three royal lines. You know, I got them on charts as well if you're interested in looking out. Now I want to move away a little bit from genealogy since I have a few more minutes here. After 30 years of genealogy in the courthouses and looking at these records, I decided that I want these back. This one for Brooke. I decided I wanted to try to do a book about my little hometown. So the picture on the cover is the picture on the on my on the screen here. And Kurt Mariner is a retired Methodist minister who actually, if any of you are Methodist here in McLean, he was a Methodist minister here in McLean in the 80s and 90s. So he's retired to the Eastern Shore. And this is his ninth Eastern Shore history book about the little town of Axis. And I mean, well, there's 200 people living there now. But I convinced him to put a little bit of genealogy book, because he didn't want to put any in there. But we did just a little bit. But one of the things that helped me do the history of Saxes was land ownership and genealogy. So for those of you who have that book, if you look on page 89, and I'm going to show you that on the screen here. How to use deed books and land patents and possession of returns to actually do your genealogy. So the first thing I found was that the welcome sign was Saxon's Island got a mistake on it. Should be a six, not a four. The island was patented in land was patented in 1666 in two tracts. The northern tract up here went to 150 acres went to a Robert Sykes, who the island was named after, and the lower 200 acres went to a Parker. It's another picture of the house. When we're over there, we did.
To George Parker?
Right in here.
What do you mean, my George?
There's a lot of Parkers, believe me, lots of Parkers.
Yeah, they all named George.
Interesting enough, this is the entrance to the Pocomoke River, and this is the Maryland, Virginia state line right up through here. So this is Somerset County back here. Chrisfield is over here, and Chincoteague is over there. This is the old boat graveyard. So what I did was I started out with these two land patents in 1666, 150 acres up here to Robert Sykes, and the 200 acres down here to George Parker. Now, what I'm trying to do is trace the ownership of and how the land finally got divided up, the 350 acres. The underlying map here is an 1853 map by the U.S. Coast Survey, now called the Coast and Geodetic Survey, a branch of NOAA. By the way, I worked for the Army Corps of Engineers for 38 years here in Washington. So the Corps of Engineers and NOAA and all these organizations, all the mapping and engineering guys all work together, so I know most of them. So but anyway, this William Anderson ended up owning both the north, both ends of the island, by 1671. He ended up owning the island for almost 27 years. But these folks never really lived there. They just used it to field their cattle on it. So we call it absentee landlords. They own the island. In fact, William Anderson, when he wrote his will in 1689, I think he pretty much spelled out what was on his plantation on Thaxes Island. So what I'm going to do is step through, starting in the beginning, and each one of these represent another block of time. So this represents the time block from 1698 to 1743. By this time, John Kendall's come into possession of this. And you wonder why John Kendall owned it? Well, he married one of William Anderson's granddaughters. William Anderson had two daughters, Naomi, who married the Reverend Francis McKinley, who started the Presbyterian Church. His other daughter, Comfort, married a tailor, and she had six daughters. And it was Anderson and her both left their land on Thaxes Island to her six daughters. Now, this is a key to a lot of things here, genealogy-wise and otherwise. But this 1953 map shows where the little bit of road or paths or whatever and some fences around some houses were. So this is the earliest map I could find of the town. So I used a piece of software called Deed Mapper. It costs $100 where you can take deeds and drop them off to maps. And as the land gets broke up, you can use that to help you track things also. Also, there's a marsh here owned by Samuel Sanford, who he donated for the education of the poor children of this part of Accomack County. So you have this thing called the preschool marsh. So by 1743, you can see what happens here. The lower 200 acres of the island is left to Comfort's six daughters. And here's the six daughters and who they married. And who sold what to who. So they each all ended up with 30 acres down through here. And 30 times 6 is 180. So 30 acres of shoreline that already eroded by that time. So now we're tracking through here. So what happens is, from a genealogy perspective as well as a land ownership perspective, one of these son-in-laws here want to sell their tract of land, but they can't because the land has been entailed. Now, do you understand the entail? Okay, some of you are shaking both ways. So what happens? William Anderson leaves Thaxes Island to his daughter Comfort and then to her daughters and their heirs forever. And so it was his intent that Thaxes Island stay in the family for eternity. Well, he owned thousands of acres and he never lived here. And so what happens is it's fine. They keep leasing out the land, having cattle over there. But, 50 years later, some of these people who have married these daughters, they want to sell their little tract. So, but they can't because it's been entailed. So what they had to do back then was, now this is still a colony in 1743, so they had it surveyed, and the surveyor, Thomas Teagle, divided the southern 200 acres up into six equal parts, and he recorded the survey with the secretary of the colony in Richmond at the time. And the entail was docked by an act of the General Assembly of Virginia, allowing the six parts to be sold separately. They actually had to have an act of the assembly voted on to break the entail. Now, this became so prevalent that eventually the Virginia colony passed a law that says illegal to entail your land. So any lawyer working with that will wouldn't let them do that, but some of them still tended to do that. So where did I do? I go to go down to Richmond and talk to the state archive. This is now a retired friend of mine, Conley Edwards. And I said, any chance that this survey made in 1743 that was recorded with the colony is still around? And he goes, M.K., we should have a whole room full of them, but we've got one box full of them, and I'll look. He said, no, it's not there. So I wish I could get a hold of that survey. But what happened was, when they broke that entail, and divided it up into six lands, they described the family genealogy back three generations and the names of all the sisters and all their husbands and the children of the sisters and the husbands. So that entail, breaking of that entail and that one deed that just opened up that entire family is just amazing. So this is the island a little bit later. And you can see people now are starting to buy land from the Daughters of Comfort. And then I keep going up into the early 1800s, taking each year and breaking it down as they're selling off the land. So I ended up with 400 different deeds that I copied and typed up and tried to organize into this thing. My objective was to just keep doing this until I got to the 1850 census. The 1850 census is the one that lists everybody in the household. And so I believe this is the 1850 census for Sanctus Island. And I'm sort of thinking, based on all those deeds and everything, who sold who to what, that this is where George Linton lived, and this is where James Marshall lived, so forth and so on. By the way, this is my great-great-grandfather, Parker Miles, lived right here. And the little harbor's right here in the little house we have over here. So I haven't gone real far since. So. Parker Miles first bought land on the island in about 1820. Now, what's amazing about Baxter's Island, that little teeny place, 220 people, passed it in 1666, right across from Somerset County, Maryland. Some of the first settlers who came over around 1750 that actually bought land and lived there, not just tenant farmers who leased out the land, were one of the first, the first one was the Samuel Marshall. You see, I have the 78 in parentheses there. In Mr. Dorman's book, First Families in Virginia, Adventures of First in Person, Samuel Marshall is in that book as a descendant of Henry Carsley, and he's number 78 in the Carsley family. That's why I put that number in there. So anytime you see a number like that inside the Miles files, you know they got a First Family of Virginia connection that you can trace back. So this guy has a line that goes to Henry Carsley and qualifies him First Families of Virginia, right? And here's his sons. So all the descendants of these sons. And then the other ones were, here comes another bunch of them here. Well, there's a Nathaniel, a Littleton Starling that came over from Walsonia in Somerset County. And he's also in the book. The north end of the island was settled by the Marshall family, the southern end by the Starlings. Both of them can be traced to Jamestown, and both of them have royal lines. The Crabbers and Arsterman living on Saxon Island today, until this book was published, had no idea that they, most all of them can trace their lines to Jamestown and to royalty. And I want to add one more. This is the rest of it. I want to add one more thing about DNA. I just recently did this. I had a friend who questioned my genealogy on this Marshall family. And he said, I don't think they came over from Somerset County. So I mailed him a copy of the book, and he's still skeptical. So he says, just because you put it in a book, I'll make it right. I said, okay. And his name is Marshall. And so, and he is into the, he has a Marshall DNA website. So there's three Marshall families in that area. And so it's a matter of which one settled Saxon Island. And he said he couldn't tell. He didn't think it came from either one of the three known Marshalls. So there were two DNA samples available that we knew about. One from Northampton in his line, who came from Accomack Earl. So you see these six sons born in 1750. I have a friend of mine I grew up with who's a descendant. His name is Samuel Marshall, believe it or not. Samuel Marshall. He's a seventh generation descendant of this guy right here. I found another one who worked with my father. He's a seventh generation of this James Marshall. Seventh generation. One comes from this son, one comes from this son. They submitted their, I paid for their DNA samples. Jim Marshall calls me up one day. I'm driving down the road. I put it on speakerphone so my wife can hear. He says, MK, good news. I said, what's that? He says, at the seventh generation, they're 99.999999. Only one marker difference out of 47 markers. He said you are absolutely right. Couldn't be any other way. Now, I had a third DNA sample from a guy on Zach's, and his doesn't match anybody. So. I don't know about this DNA stuff. Yeah, so. Okay, so that's my backyard. That's the picture that made the cover of the book. That's the picture I took from the fishing pier that made the back of the book. So that's my almost 2-hour presentation. Thank you. No, I didn't get there without me. You all know who William Kelly White is?
No.
William Kelly White was this boy they found in an iron coffin up here in Georgetown in, about 5 years ago. And they couldn't figure out. A construction crew hit it when they were digging up a gas line between two townhouses. And he was in an iron coffin, and he had, which had a lead seal around it. He'd been mummified, so he was preserved. So the city of D.C. gave it to the Smithsonian. So he's in the third basement under the Natural History Museum, third basement down right now. The History Channel did a special on the director of anthropology there at the Smithsonian. He had identified a boy at Jamestown and a girl at St. Mary's, and the boy in the coffin. So it took the Smithsonian Institute like 2 years to figure out the remains of this boy in this coffin, who he was. So they found obituaries of 4 or 5 children that were buried in 1852. And they had it narrowed down to 3 or 4 boys that this could have been. So when they did the autopsy on the mummified remains, they figured out how old he was. He died of probably pneumonia, and he had a heart condition and all these kinds of things. He was about 14 or 15 years old. So they started tracing down these the information, and since my will book, Accomack County will book, is, they went to the Library of Congress and got it, I guess. But anyway, it has a William T. White in it, and he's about the right age, so they figured that's who it was. So what they did was they... See, he still had enough material tissues left that they could do DNA, but they had to do mitochondrial DNA. So they were looking for a female, a sister's continuous female line. See, he had no children, of course, because he died at 15. So they had to do a sister. So they looked up sisters and traced daughters of daughters of daughters of daughters, and they were, all the DNA were coming up negative. So not matching his. So they finally contacted, using the Miles files, they contacted the library over there who hosts the Miles files, and he put them in touch with me. And Debbie from the Smithsonian called me one day and said, "Well, you know, something's wrong here, because we've done William T. White, and the one that offered is probably William T. White, but the DNA doesn't match." I said, "Okay, so you have the wrong William White. There's another William White in my will book who didn't have the middle initial T in will book. In reality, he had initial T. They just didn't put it in the will book." So she says, "Well, who do you think he is?" So I went down to the clerk's office up there in those old books in the unindexed and no page number guardian bonds, and found out where he was named in the guardian. When his father and mother both died, his guardian was appointed. And it was his guardian who later left the will and named him in it, where she left him money to go to school. And so I called Deb back and told her who he was and who his sister was and who the granddaughter of his sister was. I had traced her in the Miles files up to about the 1900 census. So they just went 2 or 3 more generations, found this lady in Pennsylvania, called her up, met her at a Denny's restaurant, swapped her cheek. 2 weeks later, she was an exact match. Mm-hmm. So that's how we identified who the boy in the coffin was.
Wow.
And it made the Washington Post. It was in the Washington Post 3 or 4 times as they went through the process of couldn't find him, then they found him, and then they found the girl in in Pennsylvania. So when the girl in Pennsylvania came forth, and they had all these meetings and everything, and finally Deborah from the Smithsonian wanted to see the documents that I used in the courthouse. So when they went over to the Eastern Shore to like have a memorial service for him and put a memorial stone in next to his sister's stone in the cemetery over there, I took them up into the courthouses, and there was all these old documents. So we went to a fiduciary account, which is where they settled the boy in the coffin's estate. But since he didn't have money to go to school, and since he died young, he didn't spend all that money, his guardian settled his account in like 1853, the year after he died. And the first entry on the settlement account is a check to this college in Georgetown for his burial and coffin. So I said to Debbie at the Smithsonian, I said, we really didn't need DNA. We could have just done it from the court records. Oh, we needed that DNA. They loved it. So what I have in the Miles files is, if you go in there, you can look under William Taylor White, and I have a pedigree chart for William Taylor White in there that shows that he's a descendant of First Families of Virginia. He goes back to Anthony West of Jamestown. So that's the story about it. So usually I ask people, have you ever heard of William Taylor White? They go, no. I say, have you heard of the boy in the iron coffin? And usually somebody has the boy in the iron coffin. Thanks for reminding me. Any other questions? Or we've got 5 minutes. I'm glad we had so much time, because I can drag this out something durable, can I?
Okay. Well, we want to thank